Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We're up to book 15, chapter 12. As generally happens, Pierre only felt the full effects of the physical privation and strain he had suffered as prisoner after they were over. After his liberation, he reached Orel, and on the third day there, when preparing to go to Kiev, he fell ill and was laid up for 3 months. He had what doctors termed bilious fever, but despite the fact that the doctors treated him, bled him, and gave him medicines to drink, he recovered. Scarcely any impression was left on Pierre's mind by all that happened to him from the time of his rescue till his illness. He only remembered the dull grey weather, now rainy, now snowy, internal physical distress and pains in his feet and side. He remembered a general impression of the misfortunes and sufferings of people and of being worried by the curiosity of officers and generals who questioned him. He also remembered his difficulty in procuring a conveyance and horses, and above all he remembered his incapacity to think and feel all that time. On the day of his rescue, he had seen the body of Petya Rostov. That same day, he had learned that Prince Andrew, after surviving for more than a month after the Battle of Borodino, had recently died in the Rostovs' house at Yaroslavl, and Denisov, who told him this news, also mentioned Helena's death, supposing that Pierre had heard it long before. All this at the time seemed merely strange to Pierre. He felt he could not grasp its significance. Just then he was only anxious to get away as quickly as possible from places where people were killing one another to some peaceful refuge where he could recover himself, rest, and think over all the strange new facts he had learned. But on reaching Orel he immediately fell ill. When he came to himself after his illness, he saw in attendance on him two of his servants, Terenty and Vaska, who had come from Moscow, and also his cousin, the eldest princess, who had been living on his estate at Eletz, and hearing of his rescue and illness had come to look after him. It was only gradually, during his convalescence, that Pierre lost the impressions he had become accustomed to during the last few months, and got used to the idea that no one would oblige him to go anywhere tomorrow, that no one would deprive him of his warm bed, and that he would be sure to get his dinner, tea, and supper. But for a long time in his dreams he still saw himself in the conditions of captivity. In the same way, little by little, he came to understand the news he had been told after his rescue about the death of Prince Andrew, the death of his wife, and the destruction of the French. A joyous feeling of freedom, that complete inalienable freedom natural to man, which he had first experienced at the first halt outside Moscow, filled Pierre's soul during his convalescence. He was surprised to find that this inner freedom, which was independent of external conditions, now had, as it were, an additional setting of external liberty. He was alone in a strange town, without acquaintances. No one demanded anything of him or sent him anywhere. He had all he wanted. The thought of his wife, which had been a continual torment to him, was no longer there, since she was no more. "Oh, how good, how splendid," said he to himself, when a cleanly laid table was moved up to him with savoury beef tea, or when he lay down for the night on a soft, clean bed, or when he remembered that the French had gone and that his wife was no more. Oh, how good, how splendid. And by old habit he asked himself the question, "Well, and what then? What am I going to do?" And he immediately gave himself the answer, "Well, I shall live." Ah, how splendid. The very question that had formerly tormented him, the thing he had continually sought to find, the aim of life, no longer existed for him now. That search for the aim of life had not merely disappeared temporarily, he felt that it no longer existed for him, and could not present itself again. And this very absence of an aim gave him the complete joyous sense of freedom which constituted his happiness at this time. He could not see an aim, for he now had faith, not faith in any kind of rule or words or ideas, but faith in an ever-living, ever-manifest God. Formerly he had sought him in aims he set himself. That search for an aim had been simply a search for God. And suddenly, in his captivity, he had learned, not by words or reasoning, but by direct feeling, what his nurse had told him long ago, that God is here and everywhere. In his captivity he had learned that in Karatayev God was greater, more infinite, and unfathomable than in the architect of the universe the Freemasons acknowledged. He felt like a man who, after straining his eyes to see into the far distance, finds what he sought at his very feet. All his life he had looked over the heads of the men around him when he should have merely looked in front of him without straining his eyes. In the past he had never been able to find that great, inscrutable, infinite something. He had only felt that it must exist, and he had looked for it. In everything near and comprehensible he had only seen what was limited, petty, commonplace, and senseless. He had equipped himself with a mental telescope and looked into remote space, where that petty worldliness, hiding itself in misty distance, had seemed to him great and infinite merely because it was not clearly seen, and such had European life, politics, Freemasonry, philosophy, and philanthropy seemed to him. But even then, at moments of weakness, as he had accounted them, his mind had penetrated to those distances, and he had there seen the same pettiness, worldliness, and senselessness. Now, however, he had learned to see the great, eternal, and infinite in everything, and therefore to see it and enjoy its contemplation. He naturally threw away the telescope through which he had till now gazed over men's head, and gladly regarded the ever-changing, eternally great, unfathomable, and infinite life around him. And the closer he looked, the more tranquil and happy he became. That dreadful question, what for, which had formerly destroyed all his mental edifices, no longer existed for him. To that question, what for, a simple answer was now always ready in his soul. Because there is a God, that God without whose will not one hair falls from a man's head. Alright, there we go, another chapter down. We're back with Pierre. This was quite a pretty chapter. Had some nice language, some really nice descriptions. But I do fear for our friend Pierre. He's just learned a lot of devastating news. His best friend is dead. His wife is dead. The little brother of his secret love is dead. You know, and also, you know, that's Petya. Petya was a close family friend as well. Karatayev, was that his name? What was the name of that other prisoner? I think it was Karatayev. That died? Well, he's dead. Everyone's dead. And Pierre is not grieving. It's too stoic. He should be grieving. He must be either in shock, or he's just not processing things correctly. Because, I don't know, it was really frightening how well he took it, right? I don't know, he had some epiphanies that seem nice, but they don't seem natural, right? All these epiphanies about He used to be looking over man's head for the answers, and they're right in front of him, and all this thing, it sounds a bit like giving up on everything, doesn't it? It sounds almost like, is his name Karatayev? I keep thinking, the old guy who was a prisoner with him, the one who decided to just stop walking because he had reached his limit, and just sit down, just gave up, right? He was being tortured and tortured and tortured. He was straining forward and forward and forward. And at a certain point, he just had enough. He'd had too much and just sat down. And he seemed quite okay with that, didn't he? And then what happened next? Kapow. He shot him in the head. It seems like Pierre's doing something similar, right? Like, what's he doing? He's just being chill. But that's fine. It's a way of him processing what's happening, but I can see him fading away from here. You know, just doing nothing. Just being sort of broken. He's not interested in anything, it seems. Except sort of these intangible things. God and that kind of stuff. Kansas 57 said, how does the news of all this death that Pierre receives in this chapter impact him? How might it have been different before his time in captivity? I think the way he's handling it is a bit like he's just overloaded. He can't handle anymore. He's overstimulated, is that one way to put it? Before his capture, I think he would have flown into a panic, maybe, or grief. He would have flown into grief, but it's kind of scary, isn't it, that he hasn't. Kansas 57 also said, what do you think Pierre will pursue now? I think he's kind of, if he's not in shock, he's in some kind of holding pattern. Right, he's stunned, is what he is. I think there will be some grief, some grieving, and then some kind of epiphany. Or maybe he'll just throw everything away, you know. One of those big, like, none of this stuff matters, I need to change things up. I really don't know what he will do next. It seems like he's fallen out of the Freemason belief and back into a sort of Christian one, so maybe he'll pursue that. De Fleury said, like the great men of the military, Tolstoy thinks doctors are only making things worse. Yeah, I did get that little joke in the chapter there. That was quite amusing. You know, despite the doctor's treatment and bleeding him and giving him medicine, he recovered. It was almost like a little joke in there by Tolstoy, a bit of humour. But to be fair, bleeding is a placebo treatment at best, and the medicine may be cocaine or opium. Pierre probably isn't the only soldier to find God in small things and think the death of his friends and family is splendid. Maybe that's it. Maybe he's just really high on cocaine and opium, and that's why he's so chill and happy. That could very well explain it. I tend not to love the God, religion, stoner babble type chapters, but this one was kind of nice. It's a little bit poetic. It didn't hammer the point home too repetitively like some of the other chapters do. And, I think it read. I was actually entertained. I enjoyed reading it. So, this is cool. This is a good chapter. I think the reason it kept me engaged is because, first of all, I was keen to see Pierre again. So having a Pierre-focused chapter was a very welcome thing. But there was this underlying worry about him, his mental state. And you know, how is he going to react to finding out about all this death? And then the fact that he wasn't reacting really is what niggled throughout the chapter. Like you're looking for hints of, is there something, you know, something going to leak through the cracks here? Because he seems a bit too together. So it kept me engaged. I quite enjoyed this chapter. All right, that's going to do us for today. Thank you very much for listening. See you tomorrow.